Thanks, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'd first like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak today. And I'm excited to share some unpublished work we've been doing, just broadly on the impact malnutrition could have on host microbial interactions, and particularly in the small intestine. So I think this is a great slide to start off with to really sum up what we're interested in, and that is, first, malnutrition. And as most of you know, malnutrition is a significant worldwide health issue, actually, particularly in children. So one-fifth of all deaths in children under 5 years of age is actually due to the impact of malnutrition. And what we're beginning to realize now is that malnutrition is not really only a problem of food insecurity, it's actually a microbiological problem. So it starts in childhood malnutrition, and that can actually alter the development of the immune system and even lead to oral vaccine failure. This in part, particularly in children being raised in more developing countries with poor sanitation, this leads to increased predisposition for infection with enteropathogens, as well as an increased prevalence of colonization by potential pathobionts in the environment. So these things can lead to malabsorption and chronic intestinal inflammation in the small intestine. And this is the region where we absorb most of our nutrients. There's a particular disease that is actually now known to be widely impactful on malnutrition. That's called environmental enteropathy. And so this disease actually feeds back in this vicious cycle that's already been mentioned on how it feeds back in and exacerbates the original malnutrition in the children. So what is environmental enteropathy? Well, now it's known as actually the major contributor to worldwide malnutrition. And it's really only seen in areas with high levels of fecal-oral contamination. So some of the features are gross stunting in young kids. And interestingly, this happens in the absence of diarrhea. So it's actually a subclinical condition. Another main thing that you can see is if you were to do a biopsy in children in the USA, and this is a healthy two-year-old child, if you look at the small intestine, you see there's this long villi for the absorption of nutrients, and you see the proper organization of the enterocytes. But if you were going to look at the children in, say, Malawi, this is another two-year-old child, and this is their small intestine, you'll see this blunting of the villi, this inflammatory infiltrate that comes in, and this lengthening of the crypts along here. So you can imagine that a child with this villous architecture will not be able to absorb the nutrients as a kid in the USA would. So this leads to malabsorption, there's chronic gut inflammation. Another thing that you see is increased intestinal permeability as well. And in some of the limited culture-based studies that have been done on the small intestine, they actually show presence of bacterial overgrowth or species that are usually restricted to the ileum or the colon of kids. So as I said, this presents without diarrhea. And so far, it's independent of any known infectious etiology. So what we are interested in doing is try to mirror a lot of the clinical studies that are being done, mostly funded by the Gates Foundation, and try to understand really what are the mechanisms behind this disorder. And I think learning from disease such as IBD, it's really important to understand what's going on, how the microbiota interact with the host. And I think the best way to do this is to try to develop an animal model. And for the environmental enteropathy, no animal model currently exists. And there's actually very little known about the mechanisms or the etiology of the disease. And I think that's because the small intestine in humans is quite hard to sample, and that's where all the action is in this disease. So another reason why you'd want an animal model is to try to validate biomarkers for human use. And I think that if you're trying to use an in vitro model, this wouldn't really capture the complex interplay between the microbiome, metabolism, and nutrition. So the hypothesis we have is that there's some early life trigger. This is in the small intestine, that normally it's colonized by these mostly gram-positive microbes. However, there's a trigger, and this could be, say, the diet change or a microbial exposure change, that leads to this proliferation of, say, pathobionts, gram-negative bugs. And this can lead to this villous atrophy and all the sequela of enteropathy. So our strategy was to take young Black 6 mice, and we modulate their diet and their microbial exposure early in life. And we look at five of the main readouts of enteropathy, and that is increased permeability, microbial dysbiosis in the small intestine, looking at for villous blunting, gut inflammation, and looking at their growth potential, or look for gross stunting. So what we took advantage of was we treated mice with a diet that was quite similar to what kids in Africa or Latin America would eat, and that's moderately low in protein and fat and high in complex carbohydrates. So we randomized mice under this malnourished diet, and we actually used an isocaloric control diet, so the same amount of calories, just different levels of fat and protein. So the first thing we noticed when we put mice on these two different diets is that the mice on the malnourished diet become growth stunted, and it's about 25% less weight they gain. The mice look fine, they just don't grow as much, and they also, you can see, their tail lengths are shorter, and that's a surrogate marker for how long the mouse is. So the mice actually become growth stunted on this diet, and it's a moderately malnourished diet. So this is different from something, say, severe protein malnutrition that you'd see in kwashiorkor. Now, when you look at the small intestinal architecture, and you look at the villus length, the diet doesn't seem to change the length of the villi across the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. However, we are interested, of course, in the impact of the microbiota on this, and I think that one of the best ways to do that is to utilize germ-free mice. So what we did is we took the microbiota from the malnourished mice and the mice treated with the standard mouse chow. We transferred that into germ-free mice. We actually saw a replication of this stunting phenotype, as you can see here. So these are young germ-free mice given the malnourished microbiota and the control microbiota, and I'd like to point out that the germ-free mice were actually fed the same diet. So it was just the transfer of the microbes. And this is something that was also a little bit of a different study that was seen by Jeff Gordon's group, where they actually took twins in Malawi, who had kwashiorkor, transferred their microbiota, and actually saw that if you put germ-free mice on a diet, a malnourished diet, transfer that microbiota, that phenotype also persists. So clearly there is something in the composition of the microbiota that can exacerbate growth and development. So of course we're interested in sequencing the microbiota across the intestinal tract and try to understand, you know, what differences malnutrition can induce. And the biggest thing we saw that I'll share with you today is actually in the small intestine, and that's in the duodenum, which is the upper 5 centimeters of the small intestine. So if you look and this is 16S Pyra sequencing, if you're looking at the upper small intestine, as you'd expect in the control mice, it's dominated by lactobacillus and gram-positive microbes. And actually these Erysipelagicetracheae, these are also gram-positive bugs, so it's about 75-80% of the duodenum is gram-positive. If you look at a malnourished mouse, the first thing we saw was this, you see this expansion of the bacteroidetes, which are gram-negatives. Also, you just see there's a lot more diversity in the bugs that are able to colonize in the upper small intestine in the malnourished state. Particularly, there's a lot more proteobacteria that are there. So you look here, there's in the malnourished mice in the upper small intestine, there's less lactobacillus, and there's expansion in the bacteroidetes, proteobacteria. Also, we saw this peptostreptococci. Now, what I noticed when I looked at this is that actually the microbiota species in the malnourished upper small intestine is actually quite similar to the ileum. So it's actually possibly that the microbial species are able to colonize now this upper region. And you can see that looking at the unifract distance between the communities. So when you look at that, we saw that the malnourished duodenum was actually much more similar to a control ileum compared to the control mice. The other thing we wanted to look at with the diet is how malnutrition could impact intestinal permeability. So this is another one of the readouts for enteropathy. So the first thing we noticed was tight junction protein 1 was down in the small intestine. So this led us to believe that there could be differences in permeability in these mice, as well as we saw in the malnourished mice, there's an upregulation in the clodin 2, which is actually a protein that interacts with the tight junction structure. And this is consistent with the literature that in clodin 2 is upregulated, there's actually more permeability. But of course, we want to see functionally whether there was functional permeability issue in these mice. And to do that, we used a FITC-dextran assay. So you can label dextran with FITC, and you gavage it to the mice, and then you look 4 hours later in the serum for FITC levels. And we saw that there is much more FITC in the serum in the malnourished mice, meaning that there's more dextran leaking across the barrier. So malnutrition seems to induce a level of intestinal permeability. Now, what I've shown you is that malnutrition induces this shift in the small intestinal microbiota. There's this shift in permeability and also growth stunting. So we were quite interested in, of course, seeing functionally how this interacts with the metabolic environment of the host. And the way we did that is we sent samples from the small intestine for untargeted metabolomics. So metabolomics is a technique that's getting a lot better. So we actually were able to identify 4,200 unique metabolites, and actually 350 were significantly different between the two different diets. So this is just a plot. Basically, what you can take from this is that the metabolic environment in the malnourished mice was quite different than that in the control mice. And if you were to just look at a heat map, you can of all the changes, you can see that here are the malnourished metabolites. And you can see there's a lot of differences, you know, a lot of downregulation here and opposing differences that you can see in the control mice. So what are some of the things we saw? When you looked at the KEG pathways, and these are overrepresentation in each of the different diets. We saw in the malnourished diet that there was a lot more metabolites part of steroid biosynthesis. Also, interestingly, vitamin D metabolism. These seem to be a lot of intermediates in the pathway. A lot of things that popped up were in cholesterol biosynthesis pathways. These also seem to be intermediates, meaning that maybe there's not as much cholesterol biosynthesized. So a lot of the changes we saw are actually based on liver function, which is interesting. Another thing that popped up a lot was sphingolipid biosynthesis. And actually, we have some of these sphingolipids could be bacterial of origin. The problem is, with the database, it's really hard to distinguish host from bacterial metabolites. But it's interesting that the one phyla that colonize the gut that actually have sphingolipids are the Bacteroidetes, which we see a lot more in the malnourished mice. And these molecules are actually shown to interface with immune cells and can lead to a lot of different physiological problems, including apoptosis. So in the standard diet, the major thing that popped up to us looking at the metabolomics was that primary bile acid biosynthesis was enriched. So this is interesting because, of course, bile acids are quite large modulators of the microbiota, and there seem to be just a lot more bile acids in the control mice compared to the malnourished mice, suggesting that there is a problem with liver function. Since this is a diet low in protein, we could see that there's protein digestion and absorption. Molecules were upregulated as well. So just an idea of what we've been doing with the data set is one of the things you can do is you can do a random forest analysis to try to understand which metabolites best represent the data. And here's just a quick example of the top five metabolites that are upregulated in the malnourished mice. Of course, you can use some of these possibly as biomarkers. And the first one we see is this is a ceramide phosphoroethanolamine, and that's actually a sphingolipid that could be of bacterial origin. This is a previous biomarker also seen in malnourished patients. It's a marker of bone turnover and growth. This is an example of one of the cholesterol intermediates we see that's upregulated. And also, this is a liver metabolite that's also an intermediate. And we see lots of these vitamin D metabolites. And as I said, the main thing that we see upregulated in the standard diet is all these bile acids. So based on these data, we're quite interested in seeing, all right, which microbes in this malnourished state actually can drive or exacerbate what we're seeing in the malnourished diet. So from this, we can hop on all the sequencing data we have and try to come up with rational mixtures of microbes that could exacerbate the phenotype, and we can maybe see, you know, some of the different features of environmental enteropathy in mice. So we looked for all the typical readouts and see which selection of microbes could actually induce environmental enteropathy. So we looked for their ability to colonize and persist in the host. We looked for an absence of diarrhea. So a lot of these microbes that we screened are actually commensals, so they're not pathogens. So we took a rationally selected mixture of Bacteroidetes and proteobacteria. So these are the species that we saw were upregulated in the small intestine. And we had mice that were young mice, black 6 mice, 2 weeks on the malnourished diet, and then we challenged them 3 times with this microbial gavage. And then a week later, we sacked them and looked at the readouts of enteropathy. So this is similar. This is the a qPCR looking at the different tight junction proteins. And you can see that, and I should say that we also used the control where we took not only gavaged and malnourished mice with this mixture of Bacteroides and E. coli, but also gavaged mice fed a properly fed diet to see what the differences are. And what you can see is that in permeability, this Clodin 2 was much more upregulated, and now Clodin 4 was downregulated, suggesting there's more permeability after this gavage. Functionally, if you look at the control mice given this bacterial mixture, there's not much of a difference in the permeability as seen through our fitzedextrin assay. But if you take the malnourished mice and give it this cocktail, there seems to be what could be a biologically significant upregulation in permeability. meaning that in the malnourished mice, these bugs seem to exacerbate the permeability phenotype we're seeing. One of the most striking things we see is that when looking at the villus architecture. So when you take the mice on the control diet, like the standard mouse chow, and give them that gavage, it doesn't really seem to change the architecture of the small intestine. However, 4 to 5 times when we give the malnourished mice this bacterial gavage, you see this villus atrophy in the small intestine, and this happens in the absence of diarrhea. So it seems to be that whatever in the gavage that we're giving is able to actually colonize in the small intestine and lead to these perturbations, similar to what's seen in kids with enteropathy. And looking at the inflammatory environment, just a few of the cytokines we've looked at, and these are two that are upregulated drastically when the malnourished mice are given this cocktail. So when you give the malnourished mice this cocktail of bacteria and E. coli, you see more IL-6 secretion and MCP-1 secretion, suggesting that these mice are inflamed. And when you look at their small intestine, you can actually see, you know, the presence of some inflammation. So what we're doing here is we are giving the cocktail after they've been on the diet for 2 weeks. But we're also interested in seeing, you know, what other microbial mixtures you could give early in life that could actually change growth of the mice. So what I have here is, here's what I've already talked to you about, is the control and the malnourished mice, and that's the differences in weight gain 2 weeks later. And here we have the control mice given that bacterial gavage, and you can see there's not a huge difference in weight gain, but when you give the gavage to the malnourished mice from an early age, it seems to really exacerbate the growth stunting that you see in the mice. Now, I just wanted to see, you know, is it special, something special about this gavage that's doing this? And so let's try different sets of bugs. So we tried to give malnourished mice this VSL3 mixture. So VSL3 is a really common probiotic. I think it has 7 to 8 strains of Bifidobacteria and Lactobacillus. So we fed the mice this ad libitum, and it actually didn't seem to change too much in our hands. When looking at the weight gain or the tail length, maybe a small upregulation in the tail length, so the length of the mouse. However, no, it didn't make it worse anyway. And what we have here in the last column is this stands for Enterotruncus, which is a species of Ruminococci that we've seen in other studies actually colonizes the small intestine to a large degree. So we thought, we know this bug colonizes the small intestine, but we wanted to see that, does this bug in particular exacerbate some of the things that are happening? And it doesn't seem to do that. So there doesn't seem to be any change between the malnourished mice gavaged with this bug compared to the mixture of Bacteroidetes. Meaning that there's something, particular bugs that you're exposed to earlier in life can actually profoundly influence your growth and metabolism. It's not just you know, any bug, it's specific bugs that you might be exposed to in your environment. So from this, I hope I convinced you that some features of environments of enteropathy can be replicated in young mice reproducibly, and this could enable mechanistic studies. So here's sort of a summary of what we have, so with some of the 4 features, and what we saw with the mice just on the diet, we saw that it led to growth stunting and differences in permeability, but we didn't see any change in villus architecture or in inflammation. However, when we have the mice on the malnourished diet and you add this microbial exposure early in life, it seems to exacerbate the changes you see in growth stunting and permeability, as well as introduces a level of inflammation and villus blunting in the mice. So what we can take from this is that we can now start to think of malnutrition as a gut issue, similar to the way we think about obesity. And microbes could impact growth stunting. So early life malnutrition can impact the microbe-host dialogue in the intestine, and it could predispose young kids to increased colonization potential of these host-adapted environmental microbes. So you can imagine that kids raised in these areas with poor sanitation, they could be exposed a lot more to these specific bugs, and this could be what's driving this enteropathy, this sort of subclinical colonization of pathobionts. So microbial exposure of this Bacteroides E. coli cocktail induces symptoms similar to what's seen in environmental enteropathy. So we're doing a lot of future studies looking at human cohorts and trying to correlate what we're seeing in the mice with humans and try to understand this disease a lot more. We're still in the early stages, but so far it's moving along pretty well. And so I have a lot of people to thank, particularly Brett, and in lab, and Marta, who really helped a lot with these studies. Ben Willing at the University of Alberta did a lot of the sequencing, and we have a great metabolomics center in Canada to do a lot of the metabolomics that I did. And thanks for your attention, and I'll take any questions you have.